The one thing you'd expect a wealthy suburb to be is safe. But that's not always the case. A man's wife is late for work at the family business. He calls a neighbor. She offers to check on his wife. The front door is unlocked. The man's wife must still be at home. Apparently, she's been getting tonight's dinner ready before she leaves for work. But why is the house so quiet? Crime, investigation, and conviction may take years. But every detective knows that the crucial clue is always there, somewhere, in the first 72 hours. Dennis Berg, a successful Toronto jeweler, comes home to discover his wife Dolores has been murdered. The crime scene has been sealed off. Berg is not allowed inside. Detective Roman Boychuk of Peel Regional Police is assigned to the case.
The first thing that struck me was that there was no signs of forced entry to the residence.
The house has been undergoing renovations, but everything else looks normal and undisturbed. In the kitchen, there's a partially prepared meal. Upstairs, there's some leftover breakfast on a bedroom vanity table. Expensive jewelry has been left out in plain sight. In the bathroom, Boychuk discovers a grisly murder scene.
The victim was found nude in the bathroom, lying on her back. And there was quite a number of injuries on her body. There was no large pools of blood visible. We would have expected to see a lot more blood than we did.
As Boychuk surveys the scene, Forensic Identification Officer Frank Kavchik arrives to lead the forensic investigation.
She'd been severely beaten. She'd put up a struggle. There was also evidence on the body to indicate that she'd been washed down after the attack had taken place. Her hair was wet when we first found her, and again, the skin almost had a damp feeling to it. There was also some visible signs of some sort of strangulation about her throat area.
Before Kavchik begins collecting forensic evidence, he carefully seals the victim's hands to preserve any clues they may contain. He collects a small smear of blood on the shower tap.
Upon walking in the master bedroom, I started noticing that the bed was haphazardly made. We flipped the comforter. The mattress was moved back, and this exposed a fairly large blood stain that was on the box spring itself.
Kavchik also finds semen on the mattress. He collects a sample and sends it to the Center of Forensic Sciences. As Kavchik surveys the rest of the bedroom, he gets a picture of the struggle that must have taken place. The crime scene tells Kavchik something very specific about the murderer.
To deal with the body of the deceased, taking her into the bathroom and washing her down, you get a feeling that the person that's responsible for this is somebody that's comfortable in the residence.
Both detectives are convinced this is no random act of violence.
We came to the conclusion that the person that killed the victim was known to her.
Police focus their attention on the person closest to the victim, her husband, Dennis Berg. They questioned Berg about his movements earlier that day.
This is a very critical juncture in the investigation because he may be our killer, and we have to question him and it may be our only chance to get information from him.
Berg is calm during the interview. He tells police he and his wife had a typical morning together. He showed her some new pieces of jewelry he was bringing to the store. She planned on joining him there early that afternoon, as she customarily did. Berg says after he left, Dolores would have locked the door and turned on the alarm the same way she did every morning. Police ask if Berg knows anyone who may have wanted to harm his wife. Berg tells police he doesn't. But with the house being renovated, there was a constant stream of tradesmen coming in and going out. He didn't deal with them, his wife did. He says she made a note of every tradesman who worked on the house. Their names can be found in her electronic Rolodex, along with the names of all their family, friends, and business associates. After his interview with the police, Dennis Berg does something no one would expect of a truly bereaved husband.
The victim's husband had actually gone to work and opened his store for business, which again, we found to be very strange and something that was not what we expect.
Police continue to suspect Dennis Berg. Police check out Berg's account of his actions on the day of his wife's murder. A security guard at the jewelry store reports Berg did something unusual that day.
He had seen the victim's husband coming to the mall to open his store at a much earlier time than normal. And the time that this witness identified was not consistent with the times that the husband had given to the police when he was interviewed.
It appears Dennis Berg has lied to the police. But Boychuk can't allow himself to get tunnel vision. He has to eliminate all the other suspects. That includes the long list of tradesmen working on the Berg's house. Boychuk sets up a task force room where forensic and investigative officers can exchange information. He asks John Nielsen to help focus the investigation.
We need to know everything we can about the victim, about the husband, about their business, about their friends. And we started to analyze and try and track the victim's movements, basically moment by moment, and just backtracking to where and who she had dealt with.
It turns out that the victim placed a call to the pool company at about 8:20 in the morning. The call was then returned at 9:42 in the morning. So we knew that at 9:42 in the morning, she was still alive.
At 9:42, Dennis Berg can clearly be seen on his store's security camera. The records show Berg turned off his store alarm at the usual time and did not turn the alarm on again until he left to check on his wife. The security guard was simply mistaken.
And because the husband was on tape and the tape hadn't been altered, we knew he physically could not have committed the murder. However, we still had to discount the possibility that he had hired someone else to commit the murder.
It's a plausible murder theory, but is it true? Dolores Berg has been brutally murdered in her own home. Police suspect her husband may have hired someone to kill her. But why? Police search the Berg's background for a motive. They talk to family, friends, and neighbors. They even translate the letters Dolores sent her family in Mexico. All they learn is that the Bergs were a happily married couple.
Based on all of the investigation that we did, we eventually eliminated him as a suspect in his wife's murder. He didn't show a lot of outward emotion, which to some people would be a sign that he didn't care or that he may have had involvement, but no, that was just his nature.
Eliminating Dennis Berg as a suspect does more than put the investigation back at square one.
To come to the realization it's not the husband, and what are you faced with? And the prospect of this animal being out on the street, It's a scary, scary thought.
An autopsy confirms Dolores Berg was strangled and sexually assaulted. Her hands show signs of defensive injuries. She may have scratched her attacker. Pam Newell, at the Center of Forensic Sciences, evaluates the evidence gathered at the crime scene.
If there's evidence of defensive injuries, fingernails, either fingernail scrapings or the entire fingernails are collected.
Test results on the seminal fluid found at the crime scene turn up something unexpected. The fluid contains no sperm.
We know that it's seminal fluid. We know that there are no sperm, but we don't know why there are no sperm.
Without the packets of DNA contained in the sperm, the sample cannot be matched to a suspect. Lab tests on the blood smear from the shower tap are also inconclusive.
You have to remember, at this period, the whole DNA field was in its infancy. At that point in time, the amount of material we needed to get a DNA profile was quite substantial.
Police know DNA alone may not provide enough evidence to confirm the killer's identity.
The one thing that we could never count on was that we would provide or get sufficient forensic evidence that would ultimately solidify our case.
Dennis Berg is anxious to help police. He takes them through the crime scene and points out what is missing. A brass bedside lamp, an alarm clock, and his wife's cell phone. The missing items are a mystery to the police. Why would the murderer take these items and not the jewelry? As the investigation continues, police learn Dolores Berg was very careful about the people she let into the house.
We had tradespeople that we interviewed who indicated that when they rang the doorbell, she would first confirm who the person was before she would open the door. Even when she was home, the alarm was activated.
Police now believe Dolores Berg willingly opened the door to her killer. After interviewing dozens of people listed in Dolores Berg's Rolodex, police finally come across someone who merits a closer look. A chimney sweep named Martin.
This individual had a criminal record involving violence towards women. He also had been known to frequent prostitutes. So because of the sexual nature of this homicide, he was looked at as a suspect.
The chimney sweep says he was miles away from the Berg house the day of the murder. Police drive the route to see if he had time to commit the murder and return to his work site without arousing suspicion. The chimney sweep's alibi checks out. He's eliminated as a suspect.
I'd liken it to a little bit of a roller coaster ride. As we were going through and dealing with people that had recent contact with it, we would find points of interest that would, you know, heighten that person in a suspect scale. The downside to that was eventually we would deal with them, interview them, they would provide an alibi, that alibi would be confirmed.
1 week after the murder, investigators interview a carpet salesman identified in Dolores Berg's files as Ernie Westergaard. Police know he was in the Berg's house many times, but when he's asked about his business there, Westergaard doesn't want to talk about it. Police question his carpet store co-workers. They report Westergaard went out on a call the day of the murder and never returned. When he did come back to work the next day, they noticed something very unusual.
In the days after the murder, all of his co-workers noticed that he appeared to be wearing makeup. We're talking about 10 or 12 people who, in no uncertain terms, said that this was very, very heavily applied tan makeup, as if it was an attempt to cover up physical injuries.
Ernie Westergaard is placed under surveillance. Cab Babchick is asked to collect Westergaard's trash and sort through it for evidence. What he finds seems to confirm the carpet worker's story about Westergaard using makeup.
What we ended up getting from his garbage were some makeup pad applicators.
Police find something else that's unusual.
Found all these little slips of torn up paper, and I sat at my desk for the next couple of days, and it was like a big jigsaw puzzle. When the thing was all put back together, what was of importance was it was the date that the homicide had taken place. What it appeared that Westergaard was trying to do was fabricate an alibi and to put himself somewhere other than the crime scene using these bogus work orders.
As Mr. Westergaard became a suspect, a focus of the investigation was to probe his past to see if there was any similar behavior.
Police learn Westergaard has a criminal record that includes a conviction for sexual assault. Police now have a strong suspect in the Dolores Berg murder case. But without hard evidence, they know Ernie Westergaard will go free. Dolores Berg has been brutally murdered. Police think they have her killer in their sights, but they need more evidence.
One thing that we found out was that he, in the time before the homicide, was frequenting the dating services. We found a woman who he had met, actually, through the dating lines.
Police bring the woman in for questioning. They want to know what she can tell them about Ernie Westergaard. Her name is Anna. She tells police she was violently sexually assaulted by Westergaard, but was afraid to press charges. Westergaard had convinced her he was a successful businessman.
He was a salesman. He was smooth, he was chatty, he was charming, he was friendly. It was almost as if he had a Jekyll and Hyde personality. You know, when he wanted something from you, he would be the charmer. When you didn't give him what he wanted, he would turn into Mr. Hyde.
Anna says that she was so traumatized that she's never told anyone about the experience until now. 3 months after Dolores Berg's murder, Ernie Westergaard is arrested for Anna's sexual assault and placed in police custody.
Once we felt that the threat to the community had been removed, and that was done once he'd been arrested, time was on our side.
It takes 5 months for a new type of DNA testing to be developed that might yield results on the crime scene samples. Finally, police catch a break. The DNA results from the fingernail scrapings point straight to Ernie Westergaard.
We, in fact, were able to say he was the only person on Earth that could have been responsible.
Police learn why there was no sperm in the semen recovered from the victim's mattress. Years before, Westergaard had a vasectomy. Police now think they know what happened the day of the murder. Westergaard went to the house knowing he would find Dolores Berg alone. She recognized him from his previous visits. But this visit was unscheduled. Westergaard believed that he could use his charms to seduce Dolores Berg into having sex with him. She refused him. Westergaard became so angry, he attacked her.
She fought, there's no question. She fought very hard for her life. And it was that fight that caused the injuries that eventually gave us the physical evidence that solved the case.
After the murder, Westergaard tried to get rid of all the evidence. He made a point of tidying up the room.
He took things that he was worried about might connect him to the crime. He did work for a short time as a civilian member of a police agency. He was also an auxiliary police officer. So he had some knowledge of police strategies and tactics and procedures, and I think that is something that he would have attempted to use to his advantage.
But Westergaard's efforts were futile.
All the items, if you think about it, that were used to convict Westergaard, the semen stain, the blood evidence in the master bedroom, the nail clippings from the victim, all that was basically recovered within the first 72 hours.
When Westergaard is confronted with the evidence, he maintains he's innocent.
He asserted on a number of occasions that he has never touched a woman that didn't want to be touched. So in his own mind, he's convinced himself that he's blameless.
For the murder of Dolores Berg, Ernest Westergaard is sentenced to life imprisonment with no chance of parole for 25 years. The stories on 72 Hours are true. The detectives and forensic scientists are the ones who actually worked on the case.